This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the state of religious freedom around the world. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The U.S. Department of State recently released its annual report on international religious freedom. The annual report to Congress provides a detailed and factual overview of the status of religious freedom in nearly 200 countries and territories and documents reports of violations and abuses committed by governments, terrorist groups, and individuals. The International Religious Freedom Act was enacted 19 years ago in the United States and has placed the promotion of religious freedom as a central element of America's foreign policy. In his remarks about the 19th annual report, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said, quote, "The United States promotes religious freedom as a moral imperative and because countries that effectively safeguard this human right are more stable, economically vibrant, and peaceful," unquote. Secretary Tillerson went on to say that the failure of governments to protect this right breeds instability, terrorism, and violence. The report singles out the so-called Islamic State, which continues to target members of multiple religions and ethnicities for rape, kidnapping, slavery, and death, as one of the most egregious violators of religious freedom. Also known as ISIS or ISIL, the so-called Islamic State, according to the report, is clearly responsible for genocide against Yazidis, Christians, and Shia Muslims in areas it controls. In addition, the United States remains concerned about the state of religious freedom in Saudi Arabia, whose government does not recognize the right of non-Muslims to practice their religion in public. The report also singles out Iran, Turkey, Bahrain, China, Pakistan, and Sudan for violating the human rights of members of religious minorities in their respective countries. If, in fact, growing religious persecution not only poses a grave moral threat, but also endangers U.S. national security, what measures should the United States adopt to live up to both the spirit and letter of the International Religious Freedom Act? Well, joining us on the program to answer this question and to discuss the state of religious freedom around the world are two distinguished analysts. Katayoon Kishi is a research associate at the Pew Research Center here in Washington. She oversees the center's annual study on global restrictions on religion. And Kent Hill, he's executive director of the Religious Freedom Institute. That's a Washington-based nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing religious freedom around the world. Previously, Kent served as assistant administrator at the U.S. Agency for International Development. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Kent Hill, let me begin with you. I'd like to get your takeaway on the U.S. State Department's 2016 report on international religious freedom. What do you see as the primary source of religious persecution? Terrorist groups, states, how do you see it?
It's a combination of actors here. Sometimes it's states. Sometimes it's social hostility within countries. That's even worse in the states. Sometimes, and this is what is unusual about this report, it includes non-state actors like the Islamic State, ISIS or ISIL. And this is the first time there's ever been that kind of attention to that particular entity. But you can have threats to religious freedom from all of those sources.
Katayoon Kishi from the Pew Research Center. I'd like to get your takeaway, reading of the report, and any other observations you have based on your own center's research regarding persecution of religious minorities and others around the world.
Sure. So while I can't speak directly to what's in the 2016 report, as we haven't yet analyzed it, I can talk about what we saw in 2015's report. And there we noticed a modest increase in both government restrictions on religion as well as social hostilities that targeted religion. And this was following a couple of years of steady declines in both of these measures that we track. So like Kent was saying, we see restrictions occurring both on the part of governments around the world as well as by social actors like the Islamic State.
Back to you, Kent Hill, executive director at the Religious Freedom Institute. Now, I noticed that your organization
has said publicly in a press release that the report, this 2016 report from the United States, is sobering and disturbing. And you talk about North Korea, Russia, Cuba, Iraq, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia as among the worst government or state-sponsored offenders. But you also say that despite increased attention to religion in U.S. foreign policy, that global levels of religious persecution, violent religious extremism, and religion-related conflict still remain dangerously high. How do you account for this discrepancy?
That's a very interesting question, because it is disturbing that it's not just the State Department report or the commission report that comes out of the Congress, but it parallels what the Pew Research Center has found through the years as well. It is interesting that in the early 21st century, you would still have a rise of religious freedom restrictions when, in fact, as you correctly noted in your introduction, there is an empirical connection between countries or societies that have religious freedom and a whole host of societal goods, economic welfare, peace. You would think that rulers would understand, whether they're religious or not, that the evidence is, you know, if we want to have these goods in society, we need to promote religious freedom. It's not a question of Christians defending Christians or Hindus defending Hindus. A secular State Department or a government official should be able to read the handwriting on the wall. If we don't have religious freedom, a lot of things are not going to go well for us, and we're not going to be a good neighbor. What it tells me is that we've just got a situation both abroad, but also even in Western countries, there has been a deterioration of religious freedom. There just seems to be an absence of a full understanding of how precious religious freedom really is to human beings who you want to flourish in all aspects of their existence.
Turning back to you, Karayun Kishi at the Pew Research Center, to talk more about the findings in your report on global restrictions on religion, to see if you at the Pew Research Center can answer this question about this discrepancy between more resources and more attention, at least rhetorical attention, being paid to the need for religious freedom and the connection between religious freedom and stability, economic stability and political stability, and why then there's still such a gap.
Right. Well, one of the interesting things that we've noticed looking both at government restrictions and social hostilities in countries, so looking at government actions and then as well as social groups and individuals within the country, is that typically they go hand in hand, that in places where you have high levels of government restrictions, you also tend to have higher levels of social hostilities in the country. So social groups targeting religious groups or even religious groups targeting other religious groups within the country. But there are also exceptions to this case. So this is not necessarily the case everywhere in the world. In China, for example, you have very high levels of government restrictions on religion and yet fairly moderate levels of social hostilities within society.
I found that particular finding very interesting, the discrepancy in China between the state and then the population, that the state is much more egregious in terms of its persecution. Now, before I turn back to Kent Hill, Karayun, I'd like you to talk about what's going on in Europe. You know, we're seeing government harassment and the use of force against religious groups as record numbers of refugees are starting to enter Europe. And these aren't just refugees from anywhere. They're from Muslim-majority countries, for the most part. Syria fleeing persecution, fleeing conflict. What do you read into that?
Right. So while we don't have data on what the actual religious affiliation of these refugees are, like you were saying, most of them come from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Muslim majority countries. And in terms of government response to the migrants coming in some countries in 2015, you did see public officials making derogatory statements about some of these migrants, assuming that their religion was Muslim. In Slovakia, for example, they specifically requested 200 Christian refugees be admitted to the country, citing concerns that Muslim refugees wouldn't be able to assimilate into society. And then leading from that, or perhaps just occurring in tandem with those government responses, you also saw an increase in social hostilities in Europe targeting Muslims. Some of this occurred after the Charlie Hebdo shootings earlier in 2015, and then some occurred after the Bataclan shootings in the later half of the year. And this was not limited just to France. You saw incidents of vandalism going on in Spain, for example, targeting mosques, really all over Europe. About 7 in 10 countries in Europe saw some sort of social hostility that targeted Muslims.
Well, turning back to you, Kent Hill, even though we're seeing what could appear as a disproportionate amount of discrimination against Muslim migrants, it doesn't take away from the persecution of Christians that we're seeing, particularly in the Middle East. But at the same time, we'll talk about that in a minute, I'd like to get you to weigh in on this situation in Europe where we're seeing a record number of refugees entering the country, probably the largest number since World War II, fleeing conflict from Syria, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, particularly Syria, and the pushback we're getting from particular countries, for example, Slovakia and Hungary, which are reluctant to take their quota of refugees as being members of the European Union, even though we note recently that the European Union's top court upheld the use of a quota system that requires member countries like Slovakia and Hungary to take in a certain number of migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers.
What you have, of course, is a conflict between humanitarian concerns that we all hope the UN, European Union, will be honored, that somebody who's in distress will be helped. And there's international law which suggests and basically requires that we do that. But there's a conflict between that desire that we be humanitarian and the fear that with these refugees may be coming terrorists themselves. And the irony, of course, is the vast majority of these people are actually fleeing terror. And it's just one of those terrible things. They fled terror in one place, and they come to another, and they're viewed with hostility and fear. You can understand the fear, but we just need to be rational and sane and do a proper checking, but to sort of close the spigots, to not let people in who need help, obviously is not the right thing to do. It's not what we would want to have happen. You know, we talk about a country like Lebanon, which over a quarter of its population now are refugees, much, much greater than any place else on earth, is the demographic imbalance caused by refugees who have fled into Lebanon and can upset the balance between Christians, Sunni, and Shia. So it's not just the West, and not primarily the West, that's having to deal with these, what I think is now 50, 60 million refugees or IDPs, and internally displaced persons around the world. But it's a sign that we are not at peace, that there is conflict. And if we don't deal with those root causes of conflict, the refugees will keep spilling out. We need to be spending more time looking at what is causing folks to run than worrying about how we're going to handle those who need to run.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Katayun Kishi, she's a research associate at Pew Research Center, and Kent Hill, from whom you just heard. He's executive director at the Religious Freedom Institute, based here in Washington. And we're discussing the state of religious freedom around the world. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Abid Al-Karim Al-Shari from Sana'a, Yemen. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Turning back to you, Kent Hill, for a follow-up to your comment before we went to the break, I was wondering, in the Middle East, do you think that underneath some of these religious and sectarian tensions between Shia Muslims and Sunni Muslims, there's really a power struggle between Shia-dominated Iran, which is really exerting its power in the region, quite to the dismay of some of the mostly Sunni-dominated Arab states like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, etc.?
I don't think there's any doubt that it's more than religious differences that are fueling the problems. The differences between Sunni countries and Shia countries, many of the folks involved, it has to do with tension that has been there for decades, sometimes centuries. And so it's a mistake to think that there are just religious differences involved here. And I think another thing that we often miss in the West in particular is that the victims of violent Islamic extremism have been disproportionately Muslims. There have probably been more Muslims killed by Muslim extremists than Christians or Yazidis or others. It hurt Christians and Yazidis a lot because they're such a smaller population. So there's a tremendous struggle for the heart and soul of Islam going on that Islam's going to have to sort through itself, but there are plenty in that world who want to make a case for religious freedom and for pluralism. And we need to encourage them and help them move in the right direction.
Well, that leads me to ask you, Katayunkishi, about the U.S. commitment. The State Department says that the protection of groups like Sunni Muslims, Kurds, and other minorities who are targets of violent extremism remains a human rights priority for the United States and for the Trump administration in particular. But I guess one could say, what does priority mean? And will the actions match these laudable words by the U.S. Department of State?
I can't comment on the State Department's policies moving forward, but to reiterate Kent's point about the importance of looking at persecution of religious minorities around the world, 97% of the world's Muslims live in countries where members of their faith are persecuted, either by government forces or by social groups. And a lot of these countries are actually in the Middle East, which are Muslim-majority countries, but the Muslim groups that are persecuted are often members of minority Muslim faiths, like Shia Muslims, or like Ahmadiyya Muslims, or in Shia-majority countries, Sunni Muslims. In addition, you have about 99% of the world's Jews and Hindus living in countries where members of their faith are persecuted. For Christians, that number is a little bit lower. 78% of Christians live in countries where they're persecuted, although part of that is just because of the massive size of the Christian world population. The Christians make up the largest religious group in the world.
Well, turning back to you, Kent Hill, for your take on the U.S. role, some analysts say the administration is sending mixed messages, saying that calling out violations to religious freedom is very important for stability, political and economic, but perhaps not allocating sufficient resources to this cause. And I know your organization talks right about allocating funds. So how do you see it going forward?
I think the sin of academics often, and sometimes government bureaucrats, is that we're satisfied when we do a report. We don't go on and say, does the report lead to action that improves the situation? And I think U.S. foreign policy has often been guilty of stopping short of acting in an intelligent and effective way with the information they release. We didn't have these reports till 1998, but often the report gathers dust without any concrete action being taken to figure out how do you encourage or pressure a situation or a government to improve its performance. But frankly, we often have higher priorities, so we don't always do as much as we could and should.
Is the nomination of Governor Sam Brownback as ambassador at large for religious freedom of importance to you?
Yes.
I mean, what does that say to you?
Well, what it says to me, it's very good news. And actually, I want to credit the State Department for putting out this report in between ambassadors. They carried out and they put together a 1,200-page report. And there wasn't even an ambassador present to sort of set to push it along. They did what they were supposed to do. But having a person with status like Senator Brownback in place who can speak with authority on these things, our hope really is that this will increase our ability to structure an effective strategy that will actually make a difference.
Turning back to you, Katayunkishi, I'd like you to comment on, based on your research, if you see a greater danger from state-sponsored actors, that is, those states that persecute groups for religion or other reasons, more than perhaps non-state actors. Some would argue that state sponsor of terrorism or state sponsor of religious persecution is perhaps more dangerous in the long run.
It certainly can have a large reach. So we found that 25% of the world's countries actually fall into our top two categories when it comes to government restrictions. So either having very high levels of restrictions or even just high levels. That was a slight increase from 24% back in 2014. Now, non-state actors like ISIS have been increasing their activities, and we are seeing that crop up in our data as well. So 2014 was the first time we started seeing ISIS activity in areas outside of the Middle East. And then in 2015, those activities continued. You also have other organizations like Boko Haram, for example, ramping up their attacks. In Niger, for example, you saw an increase in social hostilities in 2015, and some of that was due to Boko Boko Haram attacks that were coming in over the border with Nigeria.
Turning back to you, Kent Hill, besides the authority of the United States, what other factors do you think could play a role in trying to diminish these trends that we're seeing, which are religious right. persecution on the rise around the world?
There's only so much governments can do. And in the end, the most powerful force in dealing with bad religion is good religion. You need the majority of religious people in any religion, whether it's Hindus dealing with persecution there, or Buddhists attacking Muslims in Myanmar, or Muslims attacking Christians and Yazidis, or extremists, I should say, attacking them there. The best prevention is for majority faith themselves to say, this reflects poorly our religious beliefs, and to not tolerate it. That's always a better strategy than an outsider coming in and criticizing. You really want to unleash the best that religions have to offer as something that can condemn and prevent extremists in any religion doing that which shames their own religion.
Well, turning back to you, Kadi Yunkishi, Kent Hill said previously also that the report is good, but it shouldn't be an end in itself. What other measures do you think, whether the United States or any other country, can take to try to diminish this trend of religious persecution?
Well, we have seen in the past governments implementing programs like interfaith dialogues within their own countries, or even training initiatives or educational initiatives between religious groups in the country. And they can continue to do programs like that. And I can't speak to the efficacy of those initiatives, but they certainly are a trend that we have noticed occurring. In terms of the usefulness of this type of data, we rely on the International Religious Freedom Reports each year, but we also look at reports from other organizations around the world. So Amnesty International, for example, does country reports each year, Freedom House, Human Rights Watch. We actually look at 18 different sources for each country to see really what the holistic picture of religious freedom looks like for each country and how have those really changed from year to year to try to really pinpoint what the areas of concern are for each country.
Back to you, Kent Hill. Some analysts are pointing to the fact that here in the United States there are some worrisome trends. For example, we're seeing the rise of some white supremacist groups, some anti-Semitic groups. Should this be of concern to the United States? And do you think it could impair or somehow impinge on the U.S. moral authority in terms of issuing these kinds of reports?
I think it is the case that there has been a slippage both in Europe, Australia, Canada, the United States. And what do I mean by a slippage in religious freedom? We seem to be moving into a time when whatever the majority opinion is on anything, there's a tendency to want to enforce that majority view on others and to not tolerate minority views. So democracies are not immune from being problematic. And here's the key point. Democracy does not just mean majority rule. Democracy always means elections, but also minority rights. There are things in a full, complete democracy that majorities cannot do. Because if you don't have limits on what majorities can do, you can have fascism overnight. Hitler came to power with elections. So you have to have a complete understanding of democracy. And if we start to lose that, if we stop being able to tolerate those within our society who happen to hold a view that is now out of popularity, we're moving in the wrong direction. And there's a lot of evidence that is the case in the West at the present time.
Kadi Yunkishi, do you have anything to add or subtract to that final observation?
Yeah, so in the United States is an interesting case because we did actually see high levels of social hostilities involving religion in 2015 in the U.S. And part of this came from an increase in hate crimes targeted towards religious groups. So Muslims, for example, saw a significant increase in hate crimes targeting them in terms of assaults targeting Muslims. That was the highest levels that we've seen since after 9/11. Anti-Semitic crimes are also on the rise, including other minority groups around the country. So this is a disturbing trend in the United States, and we'll have to see what the data for 2016 says when the FBI releases their hate crime numbers. But I would certainly agree that democracies, according to our data at least, are not immune.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Kadi Yunkishi. She's a research associate at Pew Research Center, and Kent Hill, executive director of the Religious Freedom Institute. Thank you both for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Linus Rimkus. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.